speaker output of the first radio into the mic input of the second radio, and now the push-to-talk is going to be a half megohm resistor that goes to ground, something in that order, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW in the second half.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, he didn't exactly explain what he's doing, but if you just try to pass the audio from one to the other and manually key it, you can use a small audio coupling capacitor, like a 0.01, something in that neighborhood, just put in series, because microphone input is impedance high anyway, this shouldn't be a problem. The other thing is, you know, your 8-ohm speaker, or your output impedance of whatever the amplifier is pretty low, and usually because these radios are designed to use the same wire for everything, anything that's less than 1K to ground will cause the radio to go on a transmit. So, you know, 1K resistor, a little bit bigger in series, or a small coupling capacitor, that'll do you. K2IW, K2J.
Yeah, if you used a 1K series resistor, I think you would be changing the audio frequency response. The coupling capacitor is the right way. The way many of these radios work, Ed, is that if the so-called mic input wire, that's called a coax cable, if it sees anything greater than, let me pick a number, 10 kiloohms to ground, it goes into the transmit mode. You've got an 8-ohm load on it, and it's seeing that ground and therefore going into transmit. With a coupling capacitor, you'll erase that problem. By some other means, you've now got to create a voice-operated relay circuit. In other words, when the receiving radio hears a signal that you want repeated, now you're going to have to build a circuit, which you've probably already done, which keys the transmitter. But you have been false alarming the transmitter because of a nearly DC connection. That's got to be an AC connection, a coupling capacitor, into that microphone input circuit. Does that make a little bit more sense, Ed? KT2PYT, K2RIW in the tech man.
XM with a comment.
Okay, so I'll get a capacitor, and I'm afraid I did not catch correct the magnitude of that capacitor. It sounded like 0.01, but I didn't get the scale of the units. And okay, so my understanding, you know, I'm not worried about the actual keying aspect. The radio does have a Vox capability, so the first plan is just to turn that on and see how it works. But when I get this capacitor, how do I wire it? Do I just wire it in series with the wire?
That's correct. Something like 0.01 microfarad, whether that should be a little bit bigger, a little bit smaller. There's a conflict of interest here. As you make the capacitor very large, it'll have a relatively long settling time as far as the DC voltage that makes it go from the transmit to the receive mode. If you make the capacitor too small, you'll lose some of the low frequency notes. 0.01 microfarads, small disc ceramic capacitor, or one of these chip capacitors.
0.001 could be better.
Maybe 0.001. So somewhere between 0.001 and 0.01 is going to be the right number for you, most likely. Now, there's somebody else who wants to give us a piece of information. He talked first, keyed late, and all we heard was blank, 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 XM. Mr. XM, give us your full call and your name and your information. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, it's Rich again, WB2GXM. You should make sure that you are breaking your cables out. You know, these are stereo cables, and the ring is the PTT connection to ground. Make sure that you're not connecting by accident the PTT connection to ground when you place cables in. WB2GXM.
Very fine, Rich. Good information, and thank you. So, you make sure you're not grounding the wrong thing by way of those rings, and also, quite possibly, the audio must be capacitively coupled with either 0.01 or 0.01 microfarads, because any DC ground on that microphone input on many of these handy talkies does constitute a transmitter command turn on. Over to you, Eric. K2PYT, K2RHF, you've got it, Ed.
Okay, well, I'll take a pair of scissors to this cable and go rustle up a capacitor and see what I can accomplish. Thank you very much for the help. KC2PYT.
And good luck with that project. And please come back and tell us whether or not it works or doesn't work, because some other smart people are going to try to do what you've done. And he's in the process of making a very compact, portable repeater, which he can install at a particular site, hang it from a tree, so to speak, and now he's got repeater function by way of these two Balfang radios, because the radios themselves are like $30 a piece. Can you imagine making a repeater that's only $60 or $70 with the hardware, not counting the antenna? That's a fantastic idea. Okay, time to go over to the mailbag there, John. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Into YYL with a comment on this subject.
N2YYL, please start off with your name, sir, and then your comments. We'd like to know that. K2RAW and TechNet. My name is Dick.
Hey, Dick. Yeah, the name here is Mike. In reference to that reportable repeater with the Biofang radios, I've already done it. But I purchased a little controller that goes in between the two radios. It's a Shurcom. If you guys need to know, it's a Shurcom SR328 controller, and it's made by 409 Shop. It's one of those Japanese companies. If you go to www.409shop.com, you'll locate it there, and it's a controller for those radios.
Fantastic. You've been there and done that, Mike. Shurcom. So by going to 409 Shop, Google 409 Shop, you'll find out about this Shurcom controller, SR328, I think it's it, or 329. Roughly, what's the price of that one? Give us a couple of more words. How did you find that, Mike? How did you know you needed that controller? Tell us a couple of things. What's the advantages of using that controller? N2YYL, thank you for calling in, K2RAW, you got a mic.
Hey, I just, I was curious about it one day, and I just Googled, homemade repeaters, low-cost repeaters, and all of a sudden this thing came up, and there was a little YouTube video on it, so I saw it, and it was curious, and I just purchased it, and I tried it out, and it seemed to work great.
What's the approximate price of that controller, Mike?
I think I paid like $55 or around $60 for it. I think that includes shipping, if I'm not mistaken.
Now, you've come close to doubling the price of what Ed is doing. Tell us a couple of the functions that controller is supplying for you. You bought the controller because it supplies what functions? What do you use? What are you making the controller do for you, Mike? N2YYL, K2RAW in the TechNet.
N2YYL, the main thing I wanted to do was just actually, trigger the transmit. Just act like a repeater, but it does have some other functionality as to if you use DTMF tones on it to actually, I think, deactivate it. And I haven't tried those features yet, but you can use touch tones on your radio to actually shut it down and turn it on remotely if you want to.
Boy, that sounds handy. I can see Ed hanging this thing in a tree, and maybe at nighttime he wants to turn it off. Stop it from the repeating function, or maybe it's creating noise and interference. To have external control of it by way of touch tones, and those touch tones could be doing all kinds of fancy controls, turning on a light, turning on a horn, or whatever. So if you need some further information on this, Ed, now's the time to ask for it. KC2PYT, K2RAW in the TechNet, you've got it, Ed.
KC2PYT, does it have the ability to identify itself?
You got it, Mike. Mike, can you build an identifier into that thing? You got it, Mike.
Yeah, I don't think it has the ability to identify itself. Actually, this is fairly brand new to me. I just got it like about a couple of weeks ago. Haven't played with it fully, but I was just reading up on it, and I don't think I have. There's anything in there that says anything about ID and itself, so I don't know if you do IDs with it.
Okay, you've gone to the website, you've seen some of the data, you've seen the YouTube video they've got that goes with it. Is it possible all of the functions and maybe identification is there? If Ed goes to that website, do you believe he's going to find enough information to tell him most of the capabilities of that controller? N2YYL, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, you should be able to find what this thing can and cannot do. I don't see anything. I got some little literature on it. I don't see anything about IT in itself, but you should be able to go to that 409shop.com and get all the information that you need off of it. They have various types of controllers out there. They have simplex controllers also, and they have this duplex controller. The duplex is the one I got. The simplex is just more or less record your voice and then plays it back on the same frequency. You only need one radio for that, but this is the one. The one I picked up is the one that you need for dual radio, so that as you talk, it acts like a normal repeater. As you talk, it also transmits. And I have it also going into a duplexer, another Chinese roommate duplexer, so I only need a single antenna.
Fantastic. But that simplex repeater function, that sounds kind of exciting. Where short messages, you can send to the repeater, it records them, and then plays it back over the air from the higher location. Huh. So you could do this all with one radio instead of two radios. And let's assume that now that this 409 shop has a number of kinds of controllers. So maybe one of those controllers is going to fit your bill. See if Ed's got any further questions on this. Sounds like a great place to go to for this function. KC2PYT, K2RAW, you got it, Ed.
All right, no further questions. I'm on the website right now looking at the different options they have available. I actually already have a simplex version of this project that I put together last year. This year I'm going for duplex. So thank you very much for the help, and have a great night. KC2PYT.
As you go forward with that project, Ed, please come back periodically and let us know how it goes. That's an exciting project you've got there. Ed goes to these conferences like Burning Man, I think it is, and he's going to be supplying communication to that great big sea of people by way of hanging this repeater on a local high point. Do they have a high enough place that you can hang this repeater, Ed, where you're going to be getting some nice coverage of that great big crowd? And roughly how big is that crowd? I'm guessing it's a few thousand people, is that true? KC2PYT, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Well, Burning Man is over 60,000 people, but it's on one of the flattest places on Earth. And so I last year, when I set up the simplex device, it was maybe 8 feet off the ground, and I was able to hit it with, 50 milliwatts from anywhere on the desert. So that worked extremely well. What I'm setting this one up for is for a festival with much more uneven terrain, where there's a valley, there's a river, there's a lot of space, a lot of trees, and so the plan is to take advantage of one of those trees, get it up as high as possible, so that I've got an angle down into the valley and across the area on top of the hill as well.
That is amazing. I knew that Burning Man had a weird kind of attraction to a certain kind of people. 60,000 people gather in the middle of this flat desert. I think it's in Nevada. And I think this goes on for like a week. Boy, that must be a very unusual crowd of enthusiastic people. Amazing. And I think the whole event lasts for most of a week. Isn't that true, Ed? KC2PYT, K2RAW.
It's a little bit longer than a week. It stretches from the Monday at midnight, or maybe a little bit earlier, through Labor Day. And people are often there a little bit early and a little bit late as well. You really don't want to travel on the same day everybody else is traveling, or else you run the risk of getting trapped for 12 hours just getting off of the desert.
That is enthusiastic. We think that amateur radios are enthusiastic. Oh boy, to some degree these guys put us to shame. Time to go to your mailbag here, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Are these guys going to try to give us an impossible question again? You got it, John.
I think just for everybody to know, and Ed also, somebody just chat roomed me a message that on Amazon.com they have a thing called Bofang repeaters. Just Google that up, and there's many different types. So give that a look also. Don't forget that. Yep. Oh, this week we only have one question, Dick, but that's all right. I was blabbing so long, I ate up so much time. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on to this. Should be a simple question. KC2WGB in the mailbag. Okay. I have a young amateur here who's been experiencing some problems. He has a hard line that he runs to his antenna, and he has a rotor. He has a 50-foot length going up to as high as the rotor. Then from there, he has another 8 feet. The problem is, it doesn't work well with the rotor. What he'd like to do is put two connectors up there and put a piece of RG58 in between, more flexibility. He needs approximately 5 feet to make the full turn. Do you think that'll be an issue? He's only running 100 watts max, and this is at 2 meters and 70 centimeters. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, I've been there and done this for lots of years. All the cables going up my 100-foot tower are hard lines. Some of them are 7/8 inch, some of them a half inch. One of them is 1 1/4. So the major distance is hard line. To go around the rotator, my favorite cable is RG9, RG214. The reason for that is that it's relatively low in loss. It is a polyethylene cable as far as the dielectric is concerned. Your flexible piece of cable, you don't want it to be foam-filled, low loss, because foam-filled flexible cables will always absorb water eventually, unless you do some kind of an extremely heroic job on the connectors on the ends. So a PC RG9, RG214, double shielded, so it's got a lot of strength, polyethylene, so it can't suck up any water, doesn't have any air spaces, has more than enough flexibility. Two or three of those going around the rotator is fine. Everybody thinks each individual connector and adapter is going to give you 0.5 dB of loss. Absolutely, positively not. You can put a kilowatt at 432 megacycles, I've done it, through a type N connector for a solid 10 minutes. It gets slightly warm to the touch, like it's dissipating 0.5 watt. 0.5 watt out of 1,000 watts is something like 0.001 dB of insertion loss. The only thing in this world as a transmission line that has loss, it must have length to have loss. Your coax cables have some number of dB per 100 feet. Your waveguide has some number of dB per 100 feet. X-band waveguide, WR90 for instance, is 4.5 dB per 100 feet when it's brand new and shiny. RG8 cable, RG214, I forget the exact number, but I think it's something like 4.5 dB per 100 feet at 450. So things with length have got loss. A connector has a fraction of an inch of length. It doesn't have the mechanism for any loss unless you made it out of carbon granules. So no matter how many connectors you've got, where you've got to switch back and forth between hardline and flexible cable, and then you've got a very long mast, maybe you go to hardline again to go up the mast. Let me drop it. Don't worry about the insertion loss of connectors. As long as you're using a well-installed connector, worry about the weather-proofing of the connector. If water can crawl in there, it's going to give you grief. But to flip over to a flexible piece of cable, and you don't have to go as small and diagonal. diameter is RG58. Flexible, double-shielded, RG9, which is RG214. That's my favorite to go around the rotators. Doing it that way for years, and I get very little trouble over it. Over to you, John. KT2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGV. Very good, Dick. Yeah, I don't think he'd have any problem. He's only going to have like 5 feet of cable, and there's hardly any loss in that that he should be concerned about. Yeah, I think that's a go for him, because I know he's had to repair the cable two or three times. Not that it's up so high, it's just a pain in the neck to do it. All right, that's it for the mailbag from this week, and back to you, Dick. We'll move on to Paul. See what's happening. So a nice launch this week. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Andrew, among other companies, makes what they call flexible cable. Flexible means you can bend it a few times. But unless you make a great big watch spring out of it, it eventually will give you a failure. Many of these so-called flexible cables claim real low loss in their foam fills. But when you flex them a few times in the outer jacket, which is corrugated, eventually your fatigue snaps and starts sucking up water. You're in a hell of a lot of trouble. Whereas the RG9 solid polyethylene cable, RG214 is the same thing. It has no mechanism for sucking up water. Flexible as all hell. Because of the double braid, it's strong as all hell as long as you've installed the connector correctly. And I get very little grief out of those after lots of years of service. So my hard line goes up the tower near the rotator, flips over to a couple of feet of this RG9. That wraps around the rotator. It's got all kinds of flexibility, so you can run that rotator back and forth thousands of times without getting any grief. And I think the loss of that is, I think the loss of that cable is 4.5 dB per 100 feet, and you're only going to use a couple of feet of it. You'd have a lot of trouble measuring the insertion loss of that cable, if you know what I mean. Okay, Paul, what has NASA and all these other space companies been doing this week? And tell us about that launch on Thursday. WS2N, our space expert with, I think it's space report number 195, K2RIW. You got it, Paul.
This is WS2N and Dick Yeager. 195 is right, and I might have doubled earlier on. You know, I actually had a question, and so I might as well. It's close to being part of the space topic anyway. Let me just ask that anyway. I was wondering about something called P-band, Papa band. You know, we talk about S-band, X-band, Ku-band. Is there such thing as, as a P-band? This is in regard to radar. It's actually one of the, it's new on the Soyuz Progress, the cargo ship that's going up there. I was reading about it, and it was between 225 and 390 megahertz. Is this a category like the S-band or C-band? Have you heard of this P-band? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I didn't look at my list correctly. I forgot about the fact that you had a technical question, and now's as good a time as any. In the early days, they used to call it the L sub P band, Lima sub Papa band. In other words, a big L and a lowercase p, which is in the 300, 400 megacycle region. That was a radar band that was very popular in the World War II days. It's much less popular today when it comes to the developed nations. The developing...
Dick, that was between 200 and 500 megahertz.
Okay. There's letters all over the place. When it comes to the millimeter wave bands, oh boy. Ku, Ka, L, P, W, J. There's a whole bunch of bands up there between here and 120 gigahertz. A whole lot of letter designations. So L sub P, apparently according to John, is 200 to 500. Doesn't surprise me. So, how do these letters come about? Let me drop them. The exact frequency region of each of these World War II radars, the actual frequencies were classified. So in order to talk about those classified frequencies among informed people, they used all of these letter designations. And so they were only intended to protect the exact frequency during wartime, but people used them for so many years, so many times, that it became a standard. And so now L-band is around 1 to 2 gigs, 2 to 4 gigs is S-band, C-band is 4 to 8, 8 to 12 is X, 12 to 17 or 18 is KU, 17 and above is KA, and there's a bunch of letter designations. And by the way, the exact frequency region for each of these letters is not fixed. You look at the Hewlett-Packard list, you look at the other brand name list, each individual company has slight variations as to what frequency is dedicated to that particular letter. The letter indicates the correct region, but the exact starting and stop frequencies, it depends on which brand name, and are you using the British standard, the American standard, the Hewlett-Packard standard, and so on. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. I remember back in the 80s we had, you know, the 220 band, sort of 225, and you know, between 225 and 390 megahertz in this radar, part of a JPL deal. Well, I came across that. I said, what the heck is this? I thought I heard them all on the net, you know. So that's how that came about. Before we get into a couple of the launches that went up, I just want to mention our K2UPS, Rich, was out there, and he contacted me, and he was talking about these posters that you can get. Very inexpensive space posters, you know, between like $5 or $2 or something. And they're very nice. I was looking at them on the website. And he asked if I could just announce the website, so I'll do that for Rich. It's http://www.short, it's called shortrunposters.com/space-posters.html. So I made a tiny URL out of it, tinyurl.com/hotel-victor-x-ray-8-delta-foxtrot-9. So, Rich wanted me to bring that up, and it's pretty interesting. Nice posters. They got one nice one. I would get them had more room on the wall. Had to do with the Grand Tour with Voyager. So let me just drop it and pass back to you first, Dick, and then I'll go on with the net.
Repeater, time out.
Then I just passed it over to you, Dick.
Yeah, your timing was perfect. You only lost a half of 1 second. Paul, is your antenna aimed as best you can? Your signal is good, but there's a little bit of hiss in the background. Sometimes you aim that Yagi a little bit better when it comes to talking to the Western repeater. Over to you, Paul.
I just moved it a little bit better. Is that better, Dick? I get on the Connecticut net during the week, and I move it. That throws me.
That might be a little worse. There's a region where you think is the right aiming. The best way we can find out is to start off a little bit counterclockwise, and then as you continuously transmit and you're rotating, give me numbers. This is position number 1, 2, 3, 4. And then when you pass it back to me, I'll tell you which number gave us the strongest signal. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
There might be conditions with the wind. I went pretty far. I think the best thing to do is go in through Selden.
Okay, give it a quick try and let's see how Selden sounds.
Okay, here we go.
I'll copy, Dick. This is WS2X.
The amount of noise through Selden and the amount of noise on the Western repeater was almost identical. Your audio is not quite as crisp. I like the Western repeater first. So go back to the original radio pole. The amount of noise out of each is about the same tonight.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I think with the wind might be a problem. I agree. I was listening to you even through Selden. You sound better through Leno.
Yeah, maybe we shouldn't worry. You're 95% audio, 5% hiss. Very little bit of hiss. But there are times when you aim the Yagi a little bit better. And even though we've got wind tonight, does that sometimes change the orientation of the rotator? Is that what you mean, Paul? Wind usually doesn't make the signal weaker. Crazy weather conditions will. Over to you.
I remember years ago we had problems with the wind, the cracklings, but I think Eric's got that all fixed up over years. That's what I was thinking about. Sometimes it's just propagation. There are some nights that it's just better. Now what are you going to do? I did, before I go, I talk about the launch, last Wednesday, I got a chance to see the International Space Station go up right overhead. It was almost 90 degrees. It was an 88 degree inclination, and it was pretty good. Actually, it was during the nostalgia net. I took my radio outside. I listened to part of the nostalgia net while I was looking for the space station to go up ahead. And it was very good. It was predicted to be minus 3.5 magnitude, and it was. And I think I could see light to it. I really thought I could see that, but it is as long as a football field. But I did watch that go up ahead, and it was predicted to go into shadow. It went dark 3 minutes after the sighting. And sure enough, got overhead, and that was almost exactly 3 minutes afterwards. And sure enough, went into a shadow, and it just blinked out of existence. It was a clear night, and it was pretty cool. But I find that one website, the app that I have, Heavens Above, is really highly accurate. And it's a description of where it's coming from and where it's going, and what the magnitude's going to be. So I thought I'd mention that, Dick. Very good sighting. It'll give me, maybe about a week or two in advance of upcoming sightings for whatever area you might be in. Back to you.
Many people have used that Heavens Above site, and it works like a charm. Dave, N2APG, from time to time, tells me when a good sighting of an Iridium satellite flash is going to occur, or when the International Space Station is going to go over. And on most of those occasions, I've gone out and looked at it, and it's exactly the timing they said, exactly where they said, exactly as bright as they said. And there's even a couple of occasions in which the Iridium flash was so intense that even though the sky was primarily overcast, I saw the flash of Iridium through the overcast sky. So some of those Iridium flashes go to, magnitudes minus 5 and numbers like that. The brightest star up there is Sirius. The star Sirius is minus 1, and so you can sometimes get an Iridium flash of minus 5, and each one of those magnitudes each one of these star-type magnitudes is something like 2.4-1 ratio in brightness. So it starts getting pretty bright after a while. So that's a good sight. It takes a little bit of time to learn how to use the sight and to put in your coordinates and whatever. And even if you just put in the local city, most of the time that's close enough for things like an International Space Station. When it comes to the Iridium flash is like a mirror. And that mirror flashes a hot spot on the ground that only covers, let me pick a number, 20 miles in diameter. So So when it comes to an iridium flash, you want to give them your exact coordinates. An iridium flash that's super bright at Dave's house in Massapequa might not be quite as bright at my house in Dick Zoom's, and vice versa. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is WS2N. I haven't seen the flash yet, but we'll look for it. Read about it, and just have not given myself enough time to do it. So we'll look forward to doing that. I wanted to talk about that launch that went up on Thursday. That was a Progress launch. I think that's the one that John mentioned. Progress 63. That's the 63rd Progress cargo mission going to the International Space Station. So it successfully brought up 7,000 pounds worth of, a little over 7,000, around 7,000 pounds, I think. They usually go kilograms, but I think it comes out around 7,000 pounds for the Progress. And that's a modernized one. They have a new antenna system. Radar type of system, like I mentioned before. That's a KURS, K-U-R-S, the docking system that they use. They use that KURS radar for docking, and that's all upgraded. And they took their time getting there because they wanted to, you know, run it through its paces, some of the new stuff that they have on a spacecraft. So instead of getting up there in 6 hours, like they've been doing lately, it took a couple of days. But now it's stocked. They now have two cargo vehicles attached to the space station. Last week, the Cygnus spacecraft went up there with almost 8,000 pounds worth of stuff. That was launched from Florida on the Atlas V rocket. That worked out very good. And then we have another one coming.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
We have a Dragon Falcon 9 SpaceX going to be launched. Also some from Florida, from Launch Complex 40. And that's one I'm interested in, because not only are they bringing up supplies, but they'll be bringing up the Beam Bigelow expandable activity module, they call it. That will be docked to the third node up there is called Tranquility, and that will be attached to the apps section. So we'll be looking forward to that. I've talked about that a lot. In fact, I listened to had a news conference with a bunch of news reporters asking questions to people involved with the Beam project. And because it's a private company, they don't want to give out too much technical information, such as what are the walls made out of, or what we asked last week on the net, was how thick are the walls. I heard no less than 3 reporters go after these people, trying to get that information out of them, and they would dance around the question, and their final answer was always it's proprietary. We're not gonna tell you what the thickness is. So I've tracked down what the outside diameter is. If I was a reporter, I would have said, well, what's the inside diameter? And then I would have subtracted that and divided the answer by 2, and I would have my wall thickness. But I'm going to guess probably 8 inches, like I mentioned last week, Dick. If you look at what this thing is derived from, NASA was going to do a very similar project. Back in the 90s, they were working on the, they called it the TransHab module. The TransHab, the HAB was for Habitat. And they were going to attach it to the original, you know, the original design of the space station. Back in the 90s, they planned on connecting this, and at the time, they thought the shuttles were so safe that they would be bringing up maybe some tourists on that. So times really changed now. Now you've got private companies doing it and going up to the space station with cargo and eventually with crew next year. So, and they, believe me, they have plans on eventually bringing up private paid customers to the space station. So, but I mean, since it was copied from the Transhab, and that was a foot thick, I've seen pictures of that. I'm going to guess, well, time went by and they probably got a little bit more modern material. I'm going to say it's probably no less than 8 inches thick, this thing. That's going to attach to the space station and have another little module to go into. Back to you, Dick, for any questions. There's plenty more things going on in the space program, but, I mean, give you an idea. And here and now, I count them. Between now and the end of this year, there's 50 launches worldwide that will be going up between America, China, India, Russia, and, it's just unbelievable what's going on. I mean, and then you've got countries paying their own people, from their own countries, building these satellites and then paying other people to send them up. Even the United Arab Emirates, they're building a satellite, and this thing is not going to go just around the Earth. They're going to send it to Mars. They have a contract with Japan to launch the thing. So a lot going on, Dick, so we'll turn it back to you, and any questions from anybody out there, I'll be here. This is WS2N.
My goodness, that's a lot of launches, Paul. 50 launches just for this particular year, the rest of this year, of those five or so countries. Think about the fact that a launch is considered putting the payload in space, but the last couple of steps of putting that payload there, you're removing radomes, and you've got the final apogee kick booster, and you've got straps around the material that have to, by pyrotechnics, get released. So there's all kinds of pieces of space junk. You launch a satellite into space. In a number of cases, you're launching a couple of pieces of junk alongside of it that are not in the exact same orbit with the satellite. So during those 50 launches, just think of the number of things that are all in orbit around the Earth, the number of nuts and bolts and radomes and attaching straps and so on. Boy, for NORAD or anybody else to keep track of all of those individual pieces and calculate where they're going to be when, let me drop them. So that you can tell the astronauts and cosmonauts on the International Space Station that there's a piece of junk that's going to come into your vicinity at something like 50,000 miles an hour compared to your speed, and it's due to go by in the next hour or so. So put yourself in the protective area until this thing goes by. I think that incident happens a number of times per year, I believe, or Paul. So, that's a lot of stuff in orbit around this poor planet. And some of that stuff is at an altitude, has a low enough wind load, it's got a high enough mass to area ratio that it's going to be in orbit for a good number of years to come. The stuff you put into synchronous orbit is going to be there to the end of time, literally. And that's the reason why when a synchronous orbit satellite, which is very valuable real estate, when it runs out of the consumables, you take the last little bit of consumable left and you blast it into a higher orbit. That's the graveyard. So that the new stuff coming up doesn't have to go through that graveyard, if you know what I mean. One of the interesting things that's going to happen this week, let me drop. I think it's a brand new book that Buzz Aldrin has. He's the second man that walked on the surface of the moon, along with Neil Armstrong, on Apollo 11. in September of 1969. He's got a new book coming out called No Dream Is Too High, Life Lessons from a Man Who Walked on the Moon. Buzz Aldrin is going to be signing his book, and you can see him in person by going to the bookstore called Book Review this coming Tuesday. It's going to be April 5th at 7 p.m. It's going to be at Book Review. Book Review is at 313 New York Avenue in Huntington. That area where that book store is, let me drop it. That book store is on New York Avenue, which is really the northern extension of Route 110. And it's about one block north of Main Street in Huntington, and it's on the west side of the street. So the movie, the bookstore called Book Review. Buzz Aldrin, 7 p.m. this coming Tuesday. And I don't know if I'm going to have the nerve to do it, but as you probably know, he is heavily enthusiastic about trying to convince NASA to put forth a hell of a lot of effort into getting an astronaut on the planet Mars. And I'm not convinced that that's a good goal. Let me drop. He thinks it should be one of the next major steps of manned space adventures that NASA should be involved in. But from my point of view, it's more than 100 times more difficult to get to Mars. I think the range is 1,000 times greater. 1,000 times greater distance interplanetary as opposed to just the binary planets between Moon and Earth. It's about 1,000 times further in distance. The Moon program cost something like $32 billion in 1969 money. So something that's 100 times more difficult, I can speculate as to how expensive it's going to be. Who in the world is going to pay for that? On top of that, as you guys have heard me discuss before, the consumables required to keep a man alive in space, the amount of water, food, and air that you consume in 1 year has the approximate volume of your house and the approximate mass of your house. That's what's required in consumables to keep you alive for 1 year. Let me drop. So if you send 3 astronauts for 3 years, that's 9 housefuls of stuff just to keep them alive for those 3 years. How in the world are you going to get all of that mass and volume of consumables there? It's not easy. So, and what do you get in return for doing that? When you send an unmanned vehicle, it can roam around on Mars for years. To put a man on Mars for 1 week and bring him home is a heroic effort that's going to require the resources of 4 or 5 developed nations. The United States Congress would never pay for that. We're talking about quite a few $1 trillion to send an astronaut to Mars. So I wonder if you knew about Buzz Aldrin going to be there, and you think some people will be interested in that. Well, WS2N, K2IW in the TechNet.
He'd have to be there. There we go. There's no question about it. I plan to go with Dick, so somehow I'll get there. And it's ironic you were talking about it. Have I ever come across any astronauts? I think it was last week we were talking about meeting astronauts. It's ironic that situation has come up. As far as, I know he's pushing Mars. So is NASA. We're paying for that program now. The SLS program is being built to ultimately go to Mars with SLS and Orion. We've already contracted the European Space Agency to be building the service module. They're in the process of doing it now. The first one should be ready for unmanned test flight in 2018. They're going to send that out to a cislunar location and then bring it back. And then my guess is probably roughly one flight a year for 10 to 15 years, and they can pick up the pace and land things on Mars and get things ready and create oxygen and methane for fuel to come back in situ, you know, on Mars itself. They'll have a shot, but it's a long way from now. We're paying for it now, just like with, you know, this $8 billion program for James Webb Space Telescope that's going to be going up in 2018. We've been paying that for 10 years, you know, but not all at once. You know, it's all been divided up, you know, for a decade. Well, Mars will be divided up by, you know, probably two and a half, maybe 3 decades of course funding. Unless, you know, the Congress gets in there and the President gets in there, new President, and they say, well, we don't want it. And then that's something else. You know, they could cancel programs. We had a Constellation program ready to go. You know, plans were on the table. They already launched a test rocket called Ares. You know, but that whole program was completely scrapped. And now we're into the SLS program. The only part that survived of Constellation is really Orion, the crew capsule itself. Let me drop it. So we'll see what happens. You've got to bring the cost of spaceflight down. You've got a couple of companies doing that now. Elon Musk is working on it. He's already bought one booster back. You've got Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin. They've successfully launched and brought back the new Shepard booster spacecraft combination of both. Not only two times did they bring it back, but now they just did it a third time yesterday. They launched from Texas. It went suborbital past the Kármán line, 100 kilometers up. And capsule separated successfully with a parachute, and then the rocket landed. They're in the process of building 6 more of these rockets in their shop. And those are the ones that will eventually be manned. They have plans of sending a pilot up probably next year. So lots happening, Dick. We'll follow it along. K2RIWWS2N.
Before we proceed, let's find out if anyone listening to the space report section of the TechNet has any questions for all of the above, including Paul. If anybody's got any questions about space or anything else, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the TechNet, we're listening. I'm amazed, Paul, that you still feel that the thickness of the wall of that inflatable module is 8 inches. No matter what you make out of 8 inches, other than some kind of very soft foam, which of course would never hold back these fantastic pressures, when you take a large volume object, something that's 10 or so feet in diameter, and you inflate it with 14.7 pounds per square inch, the amount of skin tension you get from that is many thousands of pounds of tension. So you're not going to make that out of a soft foam. It's going to be a very strong material. So we use strong materials, multiple layers of it, and it's 8 inches of wall thickness. Are you really going to be able to collapse that to make it smaller in volume during the launch? And if you can't collapse it in order to save volume on launch, and if it's not lighter than the usual sheet metal type modules, then what's the advantage of making an inflatable module? But I'm having trouble believing that a balloon-like structure with 8 inches of wall thickness can be collapsed. I mean, when you take something with 8 inches of wall thickness and you're trying to bend it, that's going to have to be a 5-foot radius bend, if you know what I mean. You're not going to be able to collapse that down into a small volume. So, something's wrong with that 8 inches. I think somebody put that in there just to give it a number. I'm having trouble believing that that's the real number at all. WS2N, because it's proprietary, K2I, W, and TechNet, is that a bull?
Message for bull?
You got it, John.
Bull, I just received a message from Dave. He emailed you the Iridium flare information, just to let you know. KC2WGB, clear.
So for that Iridium flare information to be appropriate for Ronkonkoma, because the Iridium flare is like, it's like holding up a solar mirror, if you know what I mean. It illuminates a very small section of the Earth. In the case of the International Space Station, it's in sunlight. Anybody within a large number of miles can look up and see the light shining off the International Space Station. But when it comes to an Iridium flare, it's one of the flat surfaces of that antenna that shines sunlight down onto the Earth, and it's a few miles in diameter. So hopefully Dave knew the coordinates of where Paul exists. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RW, the TechNet.
Okay, very good. And yeah, thanks, Dave. And anybody else wants to keep in contact with me or ask any questions, it's WS2N@ARRL.net or SpaceNetReport@gmail.com. Everything goes to the same place. I know on Heavens Above, I do have the Iridium. I could tap into that as well. Last week I mentioned the Genesis 1, Genesis 2. They were successful. They inflated about one-third the size of the 330. They want to eventually make the BA 330, 330 cubic meter inflatable habitat. And that'll be the next challenge after being 2 years from now. And by the way, I mentioned last week they were launched by the Proton Russian rocket. I meant to say it is Depnor, the DE. It's I think it's a DNEPR. They're rockets that were originally meant for intercontinental ballistic missiles, but they've converted them over the years to space launch rockets, and I think they've run out of them. So they've come to an end. But back in 2006 and 2007, respectively, they launched Genesis 1, Genesis 2. And the pressures in there were around 6 pounds per square inch on the first one, and then I think the second one was around 10 pounds per square inch. And naturally, the one on the International Space Station will be 14.7. But I don't think it's a situation. From what I understand, they have this compressor set up. One guy reported up they bring up pressurized bottles, but that doesn't sound right. I think they have some kind of compressor set up that's going to inflate these things. And if it was truly inflatable, they could just open a door and the whole thing would just inflate from the pressure of the International Space Station. That's not the case. I saw one design on your website, and it looks like it's got some kind of four poles in there, telescopic poles that are going to push this thing out, and it's going to expand. I think it's more of an expandable thing than an inflatable thing. It's not going to consider it a balloon. Even when I talked to the engineer, this guy, on the interview, I have it on tape. He explains it as a, you know, an expandable, not really an inflatable system. So there's something up with that. I mean, they have these things in, you know, completely built in Las Vegas, different models. They got the 330 and the Beam. You know, and they're all set up, and you can walk in them. You know, it's not like there's any pressure difference between the outside and the inside, but they're all expanded. So we'll learn about it as time goes on. And as far as being protected from meteorites, that was a question too. This guy explained it. What would you rather get shot by? You know, if you get shot by a bullet, would you rather be an aluminum can, or would you rather be covered with, you know, layers of Kevlar? So, I thought that was a good remark. let me see. There was something else, but that went out of my head. Back to you, Dick.
Comment?
You got it.